From Toronto, it's time for your weekly dose of conservation information here on Canada's All Environmental News Hour. On behalf of CIUT 89.5 in Toronto and our fantastic community radio partners across the country, I'm Darren Kaster and welcome to the Green Majority. This week, we will speak to Andrew Nobrega, who is with EcoVer Sustainability Consultants. He, among many other things, is also an expert on ecosystem services. So basically the idea of how to value life itself. Very difficult question. Something I think makes a lot of people, environmentalists and everyone pretty much alike, very uncomfortable to talk about, putting a price on organisms, putting a price on life, if you will, and very thing. But unfortunately, these are things that moving forward, the way that the world is run today, with economics being the primary driver of how many decisions are made at a macro level, unfortunately is very important. So Andrew is going to talk to us a little bit about how to actually go about doing that in a positive and constructive way. Following that, we'll be having a little bit of a lighter touch. We'll be speaking to Kathleen Mullen. Kathleen is the artistic director with the Planet in Focus Film Festival. I was volunteered for them many years ago as a lowly usher. They're now on their 13th year. Very successful film festival. Lots of exciting films to be talking about this year. Basically, it's like environmental TIFF. Just as exciting, just as many big speakers and big names will be attending. Hopefully, we'll be speaking as well to Jennifer Bickwall next week, just prior to the festival, which is October 10th to 14th. Who's the, you may remember her name, she has a new film coming out this year, but she was the director of Manufacturing Consent, that's somebody else entirely, of Manufactured Landscapes. So very visual documentary. She has a new piece coming out this year, so stay tuned for that. However, we're going to start the program today with our interview with Andrew Nobrega. So we're going to go straight to Andrew Nobrega talking about ecosystem services and valuing life. So I'll be speaking today to Andrew Nobrega. He's the director of EcoVer Sustainability Consultants. And I met Andrew at a Green Drinks event, which is a local networking for environmental professionals. We actually interviewed Jim Lord, who runs the Toronto chapter of Green Drinks, although there are events all over the country in Toronto. And so I met Andrew at the last one that I went to, and we got into an interesting conversation about finance and biodiversity and all sorts of fun things like that. Welcome to the program, Andrew.
Thank you very much. How are you doing?
Yeah, very well, very well. And so you were telling me a little bit about some of the projects that you worked on, but I was just wondering if you could just introduce yourself a little bit further, just say sort of where you're interested in the environment came from and what sort of relevant experience you've had working with these sorts of issues having to do with biodiversity.
Okay. Well, let me start from the beginning. The passion that I've had my whole life has very much been focused on biodiversity specifically. So, you know, for a long time I wanted to be a vet. I was always a kid that was in the bushes looking for bugs. So it's something that really has carried through my whole life. But, you know, from a professional perspective, graduating from the University of Toronto with a degree in zoology, human biology, and environment, I came to work primarily first for EcoVer Sustainability Consultants, where I focused on green building and sustainable business management. And my focus in the industry has always been to conserve biodiversity and to try and identify where the levers are within the economy and within policy to try and enact that change. And initially it was very much, I saw the opportunities within the green building industry where there is such a demand for efficiency, there's a demand for more sustainable products to try and drive that to the industry and reduce demand on ecosystems where the biodiversity I care about exists. From there, I worked for 2 years with EcoVer in Toronto. I felt that I did want to connect a bit closer to nature, so I decided to go into my master's. So I went to Oxford University, where I studied for a master's in science in environmental change and management, with a strong focus on what we call biodiversity and ecosystem services. So this is a relatively new sector, and it's very much focusing on how do you approach financing biodiversity, not from a grant or philanthropy basis, but from an investment potential. So there's about an order of magnitude too little financing for our conservation needs globally. And by engaging the private sector and the investment sector into this space, it's hoped that we can leverage that and drive more funding for conservation efforts, mainly in tropical areas, but also including the boreal forest, which is so important to Canada.
One of the things that I think would sticks with a lot of people is when you start getting into conversations about putting a price tag on and things like, you know, species or trees, and people with an environmental inclination tend to have a knee-jerk reaction to that. You know, you can't put a value on nature, but the idea that if someone doesn't do it, then essentially is assumed that it has a value of zero. Do you want to just explain your rationale behind putting a price on nature in that sense?
Yes, and you're definitely correct in the sense that most environmentalists do have a knee-jerk reaction to this approach. And fundamentally, if you're a timber company and you have the option to cut down a tree, that the value of that tree is equal to the timber that you can get away from it, and there's no real externalities that you have to pay for associated with that. There may be some transfer costs of taxes, etc., but not any major costs associated with it. If I were a company that had this option, I have the... If we don't put a value on nature, it's equal to zero as it is infinity. If you know, I'm an environmentalist and I say that you can't put a value on nature because it's infinite, well, on a balance sheet, that is still a zero. Because if you can't put a number on that balance sheet, then it doesn't exist and doesn't combat the value of timber that the timber company is eliciting. So that's really where it comes into play, and I really do feel quite strongly that there has to be a concept of the value of nature in the economy, or else it will never be considered.
The idea that there's externalities in the environment is something that is sort of alluded to but not really acknowledged in theory of economics. It's sort of considered not to exist because there isn't a number on it. And then in practice, because there isn't a number sort of established for, say, what the value of one, you know, blue jay is or something like that, or the services of a community of blue jays, is that to what extent would you say that these numbers are left off the balance sheets, as you were putting it, because it would be unfinancially advantageous for companies to do so, versus, i.e., intentionally left off because it complicates things, or B, they leave it off simply because no one has developed a number and that's a big job, and they're like, okay, well, we don't really know what to do with this, therefore we're just going to ignore it?
No, I think there's some convenience in the fact that it has not been included for those companies that benefit from it. But fundamentally, nature is incredibly complex. And this ties back to your query about putting a value on nature, is that it is very complex, and you will never be able to fully account for all aspects that nature provides us. That is a fact. But the question is it worth putting value on those aspects of nature that we can put a value on, even if we can't have a full evaluation? For example, if you look at a forest, right now there's metrics that allow us to provide a carbon value for that forest. It's actually quite simple. But it's more difficult when you get into other ecosystem services, which are those services that are provided to human society by ecosystems, such as water quality control, which, again, forests do have a contributing factor to. There's, again, another ecosystem service, which is the provision of habitat for pollinators like bees. One-third of all crops internationally are pollinated by bees. If bees aren't provided with the habitat they need or the conditions they need to exist, pollination goes down. That's a huge hit on the economy. So these are services that are fundamental and are coming from natural ecosystems such as forests, but they're very difficult to measure. They're very complex, and there are only some of those ecosystem services which we at this time can measure and can thus put a value on. So it's kind of this, do we go as high as we can in valuation? Do we have no valuation because it's impossible to completely value the system? This is the question that we really have to deal with.
And so just to make sure that everybody's on the same page with you, when you're talking about species and then ecological services or environmental services, this would be the idea of saying, well, it could be, you know, very arbitrary, and depending on what metric you want to use, you could come up with 10,000 different numbers for the value, say, of a blue jay, of an individual bird. However, if you're talking about ecosystem services, this would be a case where bees was probably the best example, where you're talking about, okay, well, this isn't to say that the life of a bee is worth X amount of cents or X amount of dollars, but the value of bees pollinating plants, if we did not have the bees and we had to do this by mechanical means, would be $10 trillion, which, yeah, I've heard, obviously I'm making that number up for emphasis, but yeah, I've heard incredibly, incredibly high numbers, orders of magnitude higher than what it does with bees. For instance, yeah, if all the bees died out. And this is sort of what you're saying, is sort of one way that you can, on a case-by-case basis anyway, come up with some usable number to value a service provided by nature, even though you're not necessarily assigning a dollar value to the individual organism.
Exactly. And it really is... The concept of ecosystem service valuation should be very much focused on the services provided to human society as an ecosystem, as opposed to individual organisms. The type of valuation that you had talked about briefly is replacement value. You know, what would be the cost of providing that service to human society in absence? A really good example of this is if you were to destroy a wetland, what does a wetland provide? It provides very good water filtration. When you destroy a wetland, whether it's through development, on purpose, or by accident, you thus have to replace that service. In Toronto alone, we have a combined sewer system. So when there's stormwater, when there's a significant stormwater surge, a lot of the affluent that we would like to be filtered before it goes into Lake Ontario gets thrown right through the system because they have to open their floodgates. If you had more soft scaping within Toronto, whether that's green roofs, whether that's more wetlands, grassed areas, there would be a water management service that's provided by nature that would help to reduce the amount of stormwater going into these systems and help reduce this flow. That would be a free service if you just left it alone, allowed it to exist. But by putting down hard pavements, by putting down buildings, you're reducing the amount that this service can provide to human society, and thus you have to compensate, and this is the replacement cost.
Absolutely. So I think we could easily spend an entire double feature program analyzing the ins and outs of ecosystem services. I find it a terribly interesting topic of conversation. But let's come back to that perhaps another time. What I wanted to ask you more about today, now that we have sort of a gauge for what it is that you do and sort of where you're coming from on that, if you could just tell us a little bit about your experience when you went to the EU and the types of programs that they're using there to try and do this very thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just came back from the EU. I've been living there for the last 3 years, working both academia in the UK and then living in Luxembourg, working with some of the public institutions, trying to really kickstart this area of investment in biodiversity. And, you know, what are my experiences? Fundamentally, when you come back from the EU to Canada, you realize that the political structure within the EU really does affect the thought processes going forward with how they govern their society. The European institutions are broken up into a couple of main institutions, the European Commission, the European Parliament, and then many of the sub-institutions that influence it. But if you look at something like the European Commission, they're basically a very large think tank, which is not elected in, which has a long-term stance. Right now they're developing policies through 2020 that are saying, how do we create the best European society going forward, the most efficient European society going forward, the most environmentally efficient European society going forward? And this is something that when they come up with their dialogue, this isn't something that changes every 4 years with the political spectrum, as you'd see in Canada, you'd see in the States. But this is something where this will be a policy that affects them through 2020, and it will affect all of the member states. So what do you get? You get the ability to develop strong systems for carbon trading. You've seen this in the European Emission Trading Scheme. Whereas this has been a very tumultuous area in Canada where we've seen political parties staging their platform on the existence or the non-existence of some sort of tax or trading system for carbon, in which case, after 4 years, that could also be reversed. In the EU, you don't necessarily see that. You may see that at the member state level, but the European public institutions allow for this overlying framework that drives directives down into each of the states that it governs, which mandates certain targets that must be met for the benefit of EU as a community. And it's really an interesting perspective on how to do this, and it makes a lot of sense. I mean, obviously there's some things in Canada that may be better than the EU, but I do really, from an environmental and a social perspective, enjoy this long-term planning.
And so you've outlined, I think, the main advantage there as compared to what sort of happens in Canada, having to do with the political system. And obviously a lot of that has to do with simply the way that the EU is set up. Is there anything, one of the things you highlighted there was the idea that it's not subject to kind of four-year political cycles. This is a larger body that not only is independent of that four-year cycle, but because it's more than one country, it sort of averages out specific countries, kind of local political issues or you know, other people that elect governments, for instance, for reasons other than the environment but happen to care about the environment. This sort of counteracts for that. Is there anything else off the top of your head that you would say is an advantage to this system versus the Canadian system? And then are there any negatives? Is there anything about this system that you think doesn't work as well as Canada?
Well, I do think you get a strong strategic framework going forward. I think that's the big thing that it really does afford is, you know, it allows you to look down 20 years down the line, where would we like to be? The EU is in the process of carrying out their 2020 strategies, and it's in the process of developing their 2050 strategies. All of these are slightly adjustable over time. Obviously, they have to change with circumstance, but they won't change with the agenda won't fundamentally change. They will be able to measure the progress and such and adjust it appropriately, but they will not change the goals of reducing carbon or promoting ecosystems or promoting relevant social benefits. And this is really a foundation of the strength of the EU in that sense. Obviously, they're having some other issues with financing, and you could argue that maybe the planning hasn't really worked there, but I think these are things that we've seen globally, specifically in Western countries, having difficulty over the last 4 or 5 years. Another important distinction about comparing North America versus the EU with regards to its environmental policy is to really focus on the fact that, first of all, they're resource constrained and land constrained. Second of all, they've had a lot of time to try and sort out these issues, whereas Canada and the U.S. haven't really had that pressure. They have more land, they have more resources, and they're newer economies. They haven't had to figure out as much stuff under as significant resource constraints. If you look at the U.K., for example, they have a lot of difficulty maintaining their own food production for their population. They have to import a significant amount, whether it's from other parts of Europe, whether it's from Africa. Canada does import food. They wouldn't necessarily have to, though, and this is a big difference. Also looking at timber, Canada has an overabundance of timber, whereas the EU had to, at about 200 years ago, really strongly start to control their timber practices. And if you look at sustainable forest management in Europe versus Canada, they're light years ahead. Something that's not only a infrastructure thing from a political perspective or an economic perspective, but the fact is that 200 years ago, these guys had to make the decision that we're going to plant trees that can stay the course, provide us with the ecosystem services we need, because they do have a concept of that, but also the timber we need for the next 500 years. So they planted the right species, they understand the right species, and they put together a portfolio of tree varieties that work in each circumstance really well. And if you go to Luxembourg, every single forest in Luxembourg, as far as I could tell, was sustainably forest managed, FSC certified or a similar certification. They were all also used for recreation. Most of them were used for other things like mushrooming and such. So the multi-use of these forests is a key development that they've had, and this is something that they've had planned and been using for hundreds of years out of necessity of a lack of resources. Canada is still in its infancy in terms of its resources. Yes, we may have issues with beetles in British Columbia that are reducing stocks there, but as a whole, Canada has a lot of timber resources. We have a lot of ability to create food resources. So we're not necessarily resource-constrained, and you could argue that that makes us a bit lazy in terms of our environmental policy. The EU has had to, you know, pull up its boots and get into the dirt and try and figure out how can we make the most efficient use of our land to produce the resources that our large populations need. I mean, Germany has 80 million people in it, and it can fit into Ontario at least twice, maybe three times. This is a big difference, very, very big difference.
So we've outlined kind of briefly the sorts of reasons why you might want to undertake an analysis of ecosystem services. You outlined a little bit about your experience in the EU and the differing conditions that have resulted in their current structure, which sounds like you're saying has a lot of advantages kind of over the current way that these issues are thought about politically here in Canada. So just with our last minute or 2 minutes here at the end, maybe if you could give a little bit of a case. I mean, if you were going to try and present and promote these types of ideas to the Canadian government in the political climate that we currently have here, what sort of argument could you make that you think would stick as far as bringing over some of those effective strategies and actually implementing them here in Canada? What sort of arguments would you give them that why this is in their best interests?
And, you know, fundamentally, it's very difficult. It's not impossible, but there's a reason that it hasn't carried the government already. And that is, you know, the things are looking pretty good for Canada from a resource perspective. We have a lot. We don't really have to worry about it. Yes, we have to manage about it. Most of our environmental management systems are focused actually on health and safety, human health and safety. I've seen a very good report that was published by EcoJustice, probably about 4 years ago, and it was presented at the Green Roofs for Healthy Cities conference in Toronto at the Toronto Botanical Gardens. And it focused on looking at stormwater management, which is a municipal requirement. It's something that falls under their control. and looked at what the value of adding green roofs in Toronto is to that. You know, looking at what infrastructure requirements would be needed to be updated for stormwater management and water quality control into Lake Ontario in the current system. Ontario has very large water infrastructure needs going forward. They have to spend a lot of money in the future if they're going to keep it up to date. And they were able to juxtapose what investment in hard infrastructure, when I talk about hard infrastructure, I'm thinking engineered infrastructure with water filtration systems, new sewers, etc., versus soft infrastructure, green infrastructure, as they call them in the EU, which is more softscapes, grassed areas, wetlands, green roofs, that help to absorb this water and control the amount going through the infrastructure in the first place. So reduce demand for capacity within the infrastructure for water in Toronto by increasing the amount of ecosystem services provided by an increased number of green roofs, more green spaces in general. And when you look at it from a cost perspective, it makes a lot of sense. And these are the types of things we have to do, is we have to provide options when a change decision has to be made. When it looks like an investment has to be made, you have to be able to look at the alternatives to those strategies. And by infiltrating these decisions, these change decisions, with options which include ecosystem service-based solutions, in many cases you can find that they are more cost-effective. And unfortunately, fundamentally, in many cases, that's what it comes down to, is what's the bottom line. If you can convince them that the bottom line is good for their economic bottom line, but also the environmental bottom line, there should be very little reason that they would turn it down. But these things take a lot of time, and I love my industry, I love what I do, I truly care about it, but I can't say it's not a frustrating industry to work in.
Well, that seems like a downer spot to finish, but I think there's a lot of good ideas there, and there's definitely a whole lot of people like Ecovera out there trying to work on these sorts of solutions. For now, I'm afraid we are out of time, but thank you very much for joining us today. Again, that was Andrew Nobrega, Director, Ecovera Sustainability Consultants. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
All right, and welcome back. Of course, I'm Darren Kaster. You're listening to The Green Majority. That was Andrew Nobrega with Ecovera Sustainability talking about ecosystem services and valuing nature. If you missed part or all of that interview, of course, the show will be posted in its entirety on our not entirely fully up to speed and as powerful and amazing as it's soon going to be, but now reposted, reorganized, and refitted, retrofitted, like a phoenix from the ashes. Our website is back up, so we don't have a lot of the archive up at the moment, but you can go there for some new content. It's a flashy, new-looking website. It will continue to improve, both being new and its flashiness. So go ahead and check that out. The last couple of episodes are up on greenmajority.ca right now. You can go and check out that new website. We'll be implementing some new content as well. Look forward in the next few months to video content. We're going to be putting some listener polls so that you can give your input about what sorts of features you'd like, and actually take part in the types of content that we produce here on the show. I always have about 500 things to sift through as an opportunity to cover on each show. And because I don't know what other people are interested in, I just kind of pick whatever I'm interested in. But we'll be putting some polls up on the website over the next few weeks so that you guys can let us know what you're actually interested in, and we can gear the show towards our listeners, or at least the listeners who are interested in participating with the show. So you can have sort of a priority access in the type of content that we're doing. Maybe there's someone that you're really interested in hearing from, a specific interview you want to do, or just a particular type of interview, whether it be personal interviews, or we talk to scientists, covers more science news, or more politics, or more art stuff, like we're going to be covering in the second feature. We'll be talking to Kathleen Mullen about the Planet and Film Film Festival. One of my favorite features actually to do at all has always been doing documentary reviews, because I love documentaries, so I'm going to hopefully be attending as many of those events as possible. But yeah, it'll be a way for everyone to pitch in. For the time being now, we're going to go to a music break and come back with our international headlines. A couple of notes about that, though. One of them is that we're, of course, a volunteer-driven show, so volunteer obviously tends to fluctuate. Unfortunately, we've been a little dry for news writers for the past couple of weeks, so I do apologize. We haven't been doing our complete headline role. We just have some international headlines today, but that's one. If you're not interested in participating but you like the show, please stay tuned for for proper headlines coming back to you shortly. If you're interested and you like headlines, of course, we're always looking for volunteers. You can go ahead and send me an email about that you'd like to volunteer to participate with the show. You can do that that from anywhere in Canada, or just some positive comments. Maybe you don't like the sound of my voice. Whatever you want to say, send us an email at thegreenmajority@gmail.com. Again, that's thegreenmajority@gmail.com. We're going to go to a music break in a second, but I have one last announcement. We're actually going to be giving away a couple tickets to the Gluten-Free Expo. If you're a listener here in Toronto, if you're listening live, that's this Sunday, September 30th, 2012, from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. at 655 Dixon Road. That's the Gluten-Free Expo. It's a gluten-free show, products and presentations, cooking demonstrations, that sort of stuff. So we've got two tickets to actually get in there for free. They're about $12 each, so it's a pretty good deal. If you're interested in going to that show this weekend, again, that's Sunday, September the 30th, this Sunday, you can actually give us a call right now on the air, and Ryan is standing by patiently by the phone. You can call 416-946-7802. That's 416-946-7802 if you'd like two free tickets to the Gluten-Free Expo this weekend. We're going to go to a music break now, and we'll be right back with some headlines, followed by Planet in Focus.
We are a flexible and innovative species, and we have the capacity to adapt and modify our behavior. Now, we most certainly have to do so if we're to deal with climate change. It's the biggest challenge we have yet faced.
The same thing that keeps the Earth warm. CO2 may make the Earth too warm. It holds in heat. Methane, chlorofluorocarbons, water vapor, and carbon dioxide. They all trap heat.
It is important that the world get together to face the problems which attack us as a unit.
The evidence is clear.
The globe is getting too warm.
We can avoid climate catastrophes.
We can do this.
We can change the world.
Science offers us answers to these huge challenges.
It's one global ecosystem.
We can do this.
We can change the world.
Every single thing every one of us does
affects everybody all over the world.
It's one global ecosystem.
Warm, wet, cold, or dry.
Climates all start in the sky.
Warm, wet, cold, or dry.
Climates all start in the sky.
When the CO2 is high, the temperature is high.
Moving together in lockstep.
When the CO2 is low, the temperature is low.
Moving together.
It is important that the world get together to face the problems which attack us as a unit.
The evidence is clear.
The globe is getting too warm.
We can avoid climate catastrophes.
We can do this.
We can change the world.
Science offers us answers to these huge challenges.
It's one global ecosystem.
We can do this.
We can change the world.
Our use of fossil fuels for energy is pushing us towards a climate unlike any seen in the history of civilization.
Adding carbon dioxide to the atmosphere warms things up.
The rise in CO2 comes from burning fossil fuels.
When you burn them, add oxygen, it makes CO2 that goes in the air.
We're reversing the process by which they form.
We're talking about something that affects the entire earth.
Problems that transcend nations.
It is important that the world get together to face the problems which attack us as a unit.
The evidence is clear.
The globe is getting too warm.
We can avoid climate catastrophes.
We can do this.
We can change the world.
Science offers us answers to these huge challenges.
It's one global ecosystem.
We can do this.
We can change the world.
And And thank you very much. Of course, that we play. If you were listening last week, you heard that song. I'm a bit of a nerd when it comes to that sort of thing. But that was done by Symphony and Science. You can find them on YouTube under Melody Sheep. They do a lot of science advocacy, kind of auto-tuned fun songs like that. This one, I've been itching to play them for a while, but this one, finally, they did something that was specific to the environment. So if you thought that was catchy or fun, you can go look up either Symphony in Science. There's a lot of stuff by Carl Sagan on there. Or Melody Sheep on YouTube. Very good stuff. We're going to go now to our international headlines, but just first I want to announce very much the benefits to you and you and yours by actually listening to the show live. We want to thank very much Don Henry, who called in, is now going to the Gluten-Free Expo. Thanks so much for listening, Don. We'll be contacting you about how to get in there very shortly. And thanks for listening live. Thanks for listening at all. And thank you to everyone else maybe who tried. Unfortunately, those tickets are given away, but don't worry, there'll be an opportunity for you to call in soon. We are approaching our fall membership drive. So that's just a little primer for you to start putting away a couple nickels and dimes here and there to support us during our membership drive. That'll be coming up soon. Excuse me. However, we're going to do now our international headlines. First off, French oil giant Total SA says it's far too risky when it comes to Arctic oil drilling. The company's CEO, Christophe de Margerie, told the Financial Times September 26th that energy companies should steer clear of drilling in the Arctic because the environmental risks outweigh the possible economic benefits. Margerie included a scenario of a Greenland spill that would not only damage the environment but a company's image. Last week, Royal Dutch Shell had to scrap drilling in Alaska after a crucial piece of safety equipment broke during testing, yet Exxon, Italy's Eni, and Norway's Statoil have the green light to search for oil in Russia's Arctic waters, while others have confirmed to drill off Greenland. Total's CEO also stressed he doesn't want to be seen as being against Arctic exploration altogether. The company has a few natural gas ventures in the north, including a spot in the Stockman Field in Russia's Barents Sea. In other news, a new report collaborated by 20 developing nations calls on leaders to take giant steps to tackle climate change. Researchers of the humanitarian organization DARA painted a grim picture with their highly graphic paper, including a crashing world economy and a death toll of nearly 100 million people by 2030. They also stressed the products of global warming in 184 countries. They looked at history of wildfires, droughts, desertification, oil spills, pollution, and loss of biodiversity. Some of the main highlights of the report include that major polluting nations are already responsible for 5 million deaths a year. Developing countries will drop 11% of their current GDP by 2030, and large economies like China and the US will see up to a 5% loss of GDP due to these factors by that time as well. And finally, this week, the United Nations celebrated World Tourism Day with sustainability centerpiece of the event. September 27th marked the annual World Tourism Day, which strives to raise international awareness about the importance of tourism and that contributions it can make to economic, political, and social sectors. This year's theme, Tourism and Sustainable Energy, Powering Sustainable Development, pushes to attain goals in 2012 International Year of Sustainability as Sustainable Energy for All. UN Secretary Ban Ki-moon says that tourism is one of the world's biggest economies, which makes environmental sustainability an important role within the sector. Secretary General of the UN World Tourism Organization, Talib Rafi, emphasized that sustainable energy in the tourism sector can also help lower energy poverty by implementing the objectives of the Sustainable Energy for All initiative. This is supposed to ensure universal energy access, improve rates of energy efficiency, and double the share of renewable energy by 2030. Those are your international headlines. Stay tuned later in the program for Kevin Farmer, who will be joining us at the end of the program for a little bit of punditry as per usual. However, we're going to take another really quick music break, and we'll be back to speak with Kathleen Mullen, who's the Planet in Focus artistic director. So just stay tuned just for about 30 seconds or so. We'll be right back. I got a problem, but All right, and we're back with the Green Majority. Of course, the other reason that I wanted to play a little clip of that music track was that was nationally famous Ari Rabinovich, former regular contributor to the Green Majority, a technician, producer, and all sorts of other illustrious titles, who now has a one of those jobs that people pay for. I understand that's a concept I'm not terribly familiar with, but he's not on the program regularly anymore, but still supports us from behind the scenes, a little bit from his band. He's actually the drummer on that band. So again, that's Ari Rabinovich's band. That's called Just Us, and that song's called Don't Surrender. We're going to go now to our second feature. I have Kathleen Mullen on the phone line today. She is the artistic director for the Planet in Focus Film Festival. Welcome to the program, Kathleen.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
My pleasure. So I was a volunteer with Planet in Focus many years ago as a lowly ticket collector.
No, you're never lowly.
and I'm thrilled to see that, because I hadn't went at the time. I was just starting my university, and at the time I hadn't heard too much about the festival. That was 5 years ago, something roughly like that. So that would have been your seventh or eighth year, depending on my math there. But even at that point, I mean, you know, you saw some posters up everywhere there, and I definitely saw stuff, but there's such a kind of white noise of kind of activism and events in Toronto that it's very, very easy to get lost in the crowd. So I was thrilled to see last year when we did a little bit on it, but we didn't actually have someone from Planet in Focus come and talk to us. Mm-hmm. We just kind of talked about some of the shows that were happening. This year, I'm thrilled to have you actually on the program. And very, very happy to see that it's not only still going strong, but seems to have expanded greatly. So following in the footsteps here, we've just wrapped up TIFF in Toronto, and we're about to start Planet in Focus, which is October 10th to 14th. And I wanted, Kathleen, if you could just outline for our listeners a little bit exactly what the festival was and where the idea for it came from, what exactly you're trying to do with Planet in Focus.
Okay, so we've been going for 13 years. It was founded by Mark Haslam, and he started it 13 years ago. I believe he did have a collective, but he was the founder. And actually, there's a whole interview with him in our program guide. You can also find it on our website. And so, what the idea is that we screen well-made, interesting, engaging, entertaining films about the world that we live in. So it can be environmental in the traditional sense, and it can also be environmental in kind of the non-traditional sense. So, you know, and that can include, you know, films about certain cultures and their relationship to the land. It can be not more traditional. It's more like climate change issues. We play documentaries. We play fiction, animation, feature-length films, and shorts.
Absolutely. And so I was able to attend the media event that you started off with. Had an opportunity to talk to Mr. Mayor, former mayor of Toronto, David Miller, who was there. Mm-hmm. Had a conversation with Jennifer Bickwall, who's going to be joining us next week, actually, for a feature interview with her. People may remember her as the producer of Manufactured Landscapes.
Oh, director.
Manufactured Landscapes, an incredible film if you haven't seen it, based on some amazing photography. But we'll leave that for Jennifer to explain. So maybe if you want to just outline for us some of the other sort of films now, because you've got 64, is that right, that's playing this year?
I think it's 63.
And one of the things I remember from the media event was that this year was incredible for a number of reasons, one of which was that, you know, as you were saying, you don't pick films necessarily for the sake that they're Canadian. You want to create the best content because you want people to actually come out and see the show. And you were thrilled to announce that almost half of those were Canadian films this year.
Yes, exactly. I mean, you know, we like talking about the world we live in. and also, I think Canadians, you know, there's so many great filmmakers all across Canada. So we've been really excited about that. And for our opening night, we have the world premiere of Lost Rivers. It's by Carolyn Bachle and produced by Katerina Sukup. And it's and they are out of Montreal, but it's in English, and it's in many different languages. But it's about the rivers that have been covered up that run throughout the city. So we have one here in Toronto, Garrison Creek, and you can see signs where they run. And it's throughout the city. anyway, the film goes all across the world. It goes to Italy, it goes to Seoul, Korea, Yonkers, New York, Montreal, all the places where there are rivers underneath the cities. And it talks to the people in the town, and also it talks with these people who go in to, who have a fascination with these rivers, and they're called drainers, and so they pop down underground into these old rivers. So it's a totally fascinating film, and that really kicks off the festival, and that is a Canadian film. So we have many more, but that's one that I will let you know about.
Another one that really, really grabbed my attention from the trailers is actually not supposed to be, I believe this is the one where you're not, where you're, it's not actually supposed to be released yet, but the Planet and Film, it's going to be launched later. But the festival kind of gets a sneak peek preview of, if I'm putting this on the right film, was the Crushing Ice or something like that?
Oh, Chasing Ice.
Chasing Ice.
Yeah.
Absolutely incredible photography. It looks amazing. You want to tell us a little bit about that one?
Yeah, Chasing Ice is our closing night film, and it is, by a director named Jeff Borlowski, and it actually follows James Balog, who is going to be our international eco hero. We're going to be giving him an award, and it follows James Balog as he goes into the Arctic to set up cameras, time lapse cameras, to test to look at the glaciers and to look at the effects of climate change, and so he actually gives you this visual picture of climate change. I mean, it's a breathtakingly beautiful film. It won the Sundance Film Festival. It won the Best Cinematography Award. But it's also so absolutely fascinating. And James Balog will be in attendance at the festival, receiving the award and speaking about the film. We're also screening it as part of our school program. We do have an extensive school program, so if there are teachers out there listening, please check it out. We have 6 screenings, and those screenings are actually open to the public as well, but it's mostly our schools that come to the screening.
All right. And what are some of the other films that really jumped out at you this year? I mean, 63 is quite a long list. And as you said, that was kind of your choice 63 out of many, many, many more films that were solicited to Planet and Film, Planet in Focus Film Festival.
Okay.
What are some of the other ones that sort of jumped out at you as really catching your attention or that people should be looking out for as key films?
Well, we have 5 films from Latin America that are incredible. And they're all from all different countries. They're about different issues. They're made differently. Their aesthetics are different. But what I would recommend is Bay of All Saints. It's from Brazil, and it's set in Brazil. And so that's one I would definitely say is outstanding. Also a film called Canicula from Mexico, and Jose Alvarez, the director, will be in attendance from Mexico. And then the other ones are Raising Resistance, which is about soy production and GMOs, seeds, and that will be there will be a panel discussion with that film. So those are just some of the highlights, I would say.
Sure. So going with that, you said there's a panel discussion with that one. What are some, outside of the actual films themselves, of which people can check the whole playlist mm-hmm. on your website,
mm-hmm.
But other than the films themselves, panel discussions, introductions, I know that there's going to be an evening with Jennifer Bickwall as well.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the other like non-film events that people might be able to attend that they might be interested in?
Okay, so we have industry series that runs 2 days. It's on the Thursday and Friday. It's a film and television industry series, and we have panels and speakers from broadcasters, from salespeople, from distributors, from filmmakers that are coming to speak about various topics. You can find those on our website under the industry series. We also have, I said, the school program, a children's animation program. So we have quite a few things. And then within the films themselves, we have many filmmakers attending from all over the world. So that is super exciting for us, as well as local filmmakers, of course. So there's really a lot to see. There's a lot to discuss. and I'm sure that, you know, people can find something that will pique their interest.
Absolutely. Well, certainly I was looking through, I didn't have a chance to get too carefully through the guide, but there was definitely a lot of really interesting stuff that's there in it, and I'm super happy to hear that things are going so well for you.
Yeah.
Just finally now, with we've got a couple of minutes left, I was just wondering if you wanted to I mean, we're a national program here. There's lots of people. About half of our audience is outside of Toronto, so I'm sure many people aren't going to be able to actually attend the festival as well that might be hearing this interview. So what are some of the other ways in which people might be able to interact with these films? I mean, you've got a list of all the names of the films and directors, but generally speaking, are these available somewhere? Are they going to be later on the internet later, or are these plays the films that are going to be available in theaters? How can people access this if they aren't able to attend?
Well, some will be available in theaters, I'm sure. We're screening a film called Occupy Love. It's directed by a filmmaker called Velcro Ripper. I would imagine that that will have some play in theaters. And then, of course, Chasing Ice is going to be released after our festival, probably Lost Rivers and several other ones. We also do a touring program, so if people are interested in getting a hold of some of our films, so we can help them with that. So we do that. It's also going to the film's website and looking at, this would be after the festival, but looking at when they are going to be released or how to get a copy of them.
Okay, so all that information should be available on the website. Do you want to say what the website is? It is, again, just for people?
Yes, it's www.planetinfocus.org.
Nice and easy. All right. Well, thank you so much for speaking to us today. Check out that film festival, of course, if you're in Toronto. If not, take a look at the website to see how you might be able to get in contact with them or see the films. Otherwise, that's October 10th to the 14th, Planet in Focus Film Festival. Pardon me. Thank you so much, Kathleen Mullen, for joining us today.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Okay. So we're going to take another quick music break, and we'll be back to hear from our pundit, Kevin Farmer, right after this break. Stay tuned. And we're back. We've got a few minutes left here at the show. If you're tuned in or you missed any of the content today, we spoke to Andrew Nobrega at the beginning of the program about putting a price on nature, that sticky, sticky topic. You can go ahead and check that out on our website if you missed the part of the show at all, greenmajority.ca. And of course, we just spoke to Kathleen Mullen with the Planet and Film Film Fest, Planet I said done that like five times today. Planet in Focus Film Festival. There we go. Lots of F's in that one. You can check them out at Planet in Focus. I believe she said .com. Either way, if you Google Planet in Focus, pretty easy to find. That film festival is coming up in Toronto October 10th to 14th. We also gave away some free tickets to the Gluten Expo today. Thanks again to Don for calling in, and thanks to everybody for listening. We're going to wrap up the program today with a few minutes with our lovingly referred to as Dr. Doom, Kevin Farmer. How you doing, Kevin, today?
Hi, Darren.
So, is still taking with a good humor that I call you Dr. Doom, but you're living up to your title again today. What was on your mind?
Well, I'm interested in a story that was on our Delicious feed, whereby one of the world's leading ice experts is predicting that the Arctic summer ice will disappear completely within 4 years, like a complete collapse of the Arctic summer ice, which even a few years ago was considered to still be decades in the future, and he's predicting that it's now only 4 years away. And yes, I'm earning my Dr. Doom title, and I'm still beating the climate change drum. this is a catastrophe. This is a, if he's correct, and the real point is that we know it's going to collapse anyway, whether he's off by a year or two or not. The point is that the ice in the Arctic is vanishing, and this is a catastrophe on several levels. One, it represents a massive feedback mechanism into climate change. Due to something called the albedo effect, the ice at the poles is bright. It's a very bright white, and it tends to reflect light. And the less ice there is, the less of the sun, less sunlight that it reflects back into space. So, and the more the water is warm. So, what you've got is the ice at the poles represent a cooling effect on the planet by reflecting this sunlight, and the loss of it leads to warmer waters, which leads to less ice, which leads to less reflection, which leads to warmer water, and it's a feedback mechanism that we're triggering, which just accelerates climate change. Plus, yeah. I mean, there's the I'm gonna skip over just the ecological disaster that losing ice represents, and just talk about an ecosystem point of view, and just talk about it from a climate change point of view. It also releases what I consider a more sinister feedback loop, in that it opens vast tracts of land up to resource exploration. And we know there's quite a bit of natural gas and oil that's been up in the Arctic, that's been inaccessible up until now. And we're going to see, with the loss of the ice and the impending complete loss of ice eventually, we're going to see humans with access to even greater stores of carbon dioxide to release into the atmosphere, causing, again, yet more climate change. But what jumps out at me in this article is that the professor who's predicted the loss of the ice within 4 years is saying, essentially, and I agree with him, he's saying that, look, this is no longer the future. The future is here. And we don't even have time now to consider mitigation strategies. What we have to do is engage in geoengineering, because we can't afford to slow climate change now. So we can't afford to slowly ratchet down carbon dioxide emissions until the Earth is back in balance. But we need to stop it immediately. And since we can't stop it immediately, we have to engage in these geoengineering projects. And this has been a fear in the climate change community, in the environmentalist community for a long time, is that we would leave things to the point where that we would engage in these geoengineering. And anyone who doesn't know anything, I encourage them to Google geoengineering and climate change and just start reading some of the ideas that are being proposed. Some ideas have we've considered we are seriously, some people are seriously considering putting giant mirrors in space to reflect sunlight. To cool the planet by simply reflecting sunlight. Other people are coming up with schemes to make clouds whiter so that they reflect more sunlight. One that really unnerves me is seeding the atmosphere with particulate matter
In some cases, metal or iron flakes and stuff like that, and yeah, it's some really nasty stuff. I think an indication of just sort of how desperate and dire the situation is probably the best way to kind of encourage people if they're not still on the climate change is a hoax bandwagon, which is thankfully very much sinking quickly. As far as people that I speak to, I don't meet very many people anymore who doubt that. But if you're not sort of scared into action once you've been convinced that climate change is a fact, then you should be convinced very quickly that this is something that needs immediate action simply by looking up to some of the geoengineering ideas that they have to deal with this process. And you'll find, as you're describing there, that many of them are quite wacky sounding, and that should tell you just how much trouble we're in, that these options are actually being seriously considered.
Well, yes, exactly. And the point is that we have a very bad track record at managing the environment and managing ecosystems. You know, somebody decided it would be a good idea to have six pairs of rabbits on his farm in Australia so he could hunt them. And rabbits now cause $50 million a year of damage in Australia. You know, Australia has released invasive species after invasive species trying to restore some sort of ecological balance, and everything they've done has just made it worse. Like, we just have a bad track record of managing ecosystems. We've got a great track record of exploiting them. And what we're talking about with geoengineering is trying to manage ecosystems and the environment and the climate on a massive scale, like on a global scale. And we don't have any reason to suppose we're going to be successful, or that the unexpected consequences won't be a complete and utter disaster. And yet, I agree with this professor that we're reaching the point where, you know, faced with the possibility of runaway climate change, we really are in a situation where we have to consider extraordinary measures. But it just fills me with, you know, here's the Dr. Doom coming again. It just fills me with dread to think that we're going to seriously start engaging with, you know, environmental manipulation on a global scale.
Yeah, and unfortunately, that's all the time we have with today. So in an effort to have an up note right at the end of the show, that's a great reason to stay tuned in a few weeks for our fundraiser and help support the Green Majority and what we're doing. So stay tuned to our program and our website for information about that, so you can help support and help spread information that might get this stuff out there. Maybe if I have a minute, we'll go ahead and post some of those wacky geoengineering ideas on our website that are actually being seriously considered, just so people have an opportunity to take a look at the types of things that you're talking about there. Unfortunately, that is all the time we have for today, so thank you so much for joining us today, Kevin Farmer.
Thanks, Darren.
Technical production today was exceptional today, as usual. Ryan Knight is to thank for that. Web hosting and bandwidth for our podcast is provided by the web consulting firm RJG, rjgcreative.com, with web production by Arlie Crawford. You can get an audio copy of today's program. Currently not any news headlines, but you'll getting back to that soon. At greenmajority.ca, which is now back up and alive, and there's content on there. Flashy new look, and go ahead and take a look at that. Of course, you can always join our Twitter feed as well, which is at Green Majority, which is where we get all the news headlines from as well. If you have an idea about a topic or anything you'd like to hear about, you can email us at thegreenmajority@gmail.com. That's thegreenmajority@gmail.com. But that's it, unfortunately, for us this week. The program is produced live every week at Friday at CIUT 89.5 FM. It's available on campus and community stations from coast to coast. I'm Darren Kaster, and that's it for this week's live edition. Until next week, thanks for listening.